Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Aaron Brooks Show here on a Sunday morning. I know it's pretty early for some of you. It's particularly if you're on the West Coast. I apologize, but right after the show, I have to go catch a flight to London, and I encourage you tomorrow to watch live. The discussion debate I'm having with Brandon O'Neill from Spiked magazine. It should be no sound. Everybody's saying no sound. No sound. One, two, three. Let's see. Facebook, no sound. No sound. Okay. Let's see what's going on. It's on. It's on. Why would there be no sound? One, two, three. Okay, that's working. Sound check. One, two, three. Still no sound. All right. All right. Let's see. Audio, mono. One, two, three. Is there sound now? Anybody? Somebody? Yep. Still no sound. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. Sound now? Still no sound. Really? Yes, there's no sound. Yes, it fixed it. Okay, now it looks like everybody's smiling on Facebook. All right, I'm going to start all over. Three, two, one. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Yaron Brooks Show on this Sunday morning. Thank you for joining me. I know it's pretty early for some of you, particularly if you're on the West Coast. But I, in a little while, I've got a flight to catch to London, where tomorrow I will be doing a discussion debate with Brandon O'Neill. And, I encourage you all to watch it. It's going to be live stream on the Ayn Rand Institute YouTube page. So please watch it there. I'll also be putting it up on my YouTube channel as soon as I can after it'll be broadcast. That's tomorrow. I don't know. It's at 6:30 p.m. London time. You do the calculation in terms of when it is Pacific time and Eastern time, but I think it's 8 hours from the Pacific time and 5 hours from East Coast time. So I hope you guys join us via live stream tomorrow. It should be really good. Are you guys getting an echo more than usual? All right. Somebody said, why the echo? I don't hear an echo. Do you guys get an echo? No echo here. All right. So I want to talk today. I did a talk last weekend at the Ayn Rand conference. This is a student conference we do every year in Atlanta, and some of you, many of you, most of you, all of you should come next year. It's a fabulous conference. It's over a weekend. I think it's open to the general public for the most part. I think we charge a fee, and then it's free for students, and many of the students get scholarships to attend. Fantastic conference. This is the third or fourth that we've done. Anyway, this last conference was on tribalism versus individualism. I think from a political perspective, the most important topic of our time. This is what everything is about. What the whole discussion debate is about these days. I'm not sure why there is an echo. Let me lower volumes a little bit. Just maybe that'll get rid of the echo. So let me know. I just lowered some of the volume. The room is a little echoey. I can feel the room being a little echoey, but I don't think there's any kind of audio mix-up in terms of an echo. So hopefully it's not too bad, and hopefully it's listenable. So, you know, tribalism versus individualism is certainly, I think, the issue of our time, and really crucial for, you know, for the political discussions that we're in today. And so it was the topic of conversation. It was, you know, a great conference, as I said. Anyway, I gave a talk during the conference, and there were a lot of people: Harry Binswanger, Greg Salamiri, Ankar Gate, Tara Smith, you know, Peter Schwartz, and some of the scholars, Ilan Juno, Aaron, from the Ayn Rand Institute. So a whole lot of speakers. It was a great conference. So the topic I gave, one of the topics I talked about, there were a couple of topics I talked about, but the one mostly was on tribalism in economics, which I see as a problem right now, both on the left and the right. I see the rise of tribalism both on the left and the right, particularly when discussing economics. And then I was going to discuss this the last show, and we ran out of time because we were talking about the election and got a lot of super chat questions. And then yesterday I came across a video of Peter Navarro, which just fits perfectly into this topic, illustrates a lot of the issues I've been discussing about the Trump administration's approach to trade and the inherent tribalism and collectivism that entails. And also, as you'll see, as you listen to this video, think if you can find anything that differentiates what Peter Navarro says in this video and what you would expect Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren to say on the same issue. So I'm going to play the video. You know, it's only about 2 minutes. I might stop it in the middle just to comment on a few things. But notice how he talks about bankers and Wall Street. So notice the inflection of his voice as he talks about bankers and Wall Street. Again, think about, is this any different than Bernie or Elizabeth Warren? And then see how he talks about trade, and in particular, he talks about the trade deficit. Many people tell me that Trump is – all Trump wants is zero tariffs. All Trump wants is other countries to play fair in a sense of zero tariffs, zero subsidies. And he's just using tariffs in order to get to that point. But notice what Peter Navarro says about trade deficits, because if we had zero tariffs and if we played fair, the United States would have a massive trade deficit, which it has today. The trade deficit wouldn't change. There would be no change. Notice what he says, because the real motivation of the Trump administration is really to lower the trade deficit, which is, you know, we can talk about how to achieve that and whether that's achievable or whether it's a worthwhile thing. Obviously, it's not a worthwhile thing, but let's watch here as Peter Navarro talks about trade and Wall Street, right? This is, he's really talking about Wall Street. This is a warning to Wall Street. Stay away from this trade debate.
Consider the shuttle diplomacy that's now going on by a self-appointed group of Wall Street bankers and hedge fund managers between the U.S. and China. As part of a Chinese government influence operation, these globalist billionaires are putting a full-court press on the White House in advance of the G20 in Argentina. The mission of these unregistered foreign agents, that's what they are, they're unregistered foreign agents.
Now notice, we're talking about American bankers, hedge fund guys. Ooh, hedge fund guys. He had to sneak in there. They're hedge fund guys, the evil hedge fund guys on Wall Street. Their mission is, what they're doing is they're lobbying. They're lobbying heavily for no trade war. They're lobbying heavily for free trade. They're lobbying heavily for the American people. But how does Peter Navarro frame them? How does he address them? They're foreign agents. They're working for a foreign power. They're spies. They're working for the bad guys. They're working for our enemy. Right? Foreign agents. All they're doing is lobbying for free trade. What they believe, agree or disagree, what they believe is the right policy of the American government, the policy generally that the American government is engaged in with lots and lots of flaws and lots of problems. Over the last, really since World War II, you know, with progressively more and more and more emphasis on greater and greater trade and freer trade and lower tariffs. The policy of every, pretty much every president since World War II. This is now a policy which you can only lobby for if you're a foreign agent working for an evil empire, China. Let's go on.
Is to pressure this president into some kind of deal. Now, 2 points have to be made abundantly clear about this. First of all, President Donald J. Trump has done an incredible job on trade. He has had the courage and wisdom to stand up to the globalist elites.
Incredible job on trade? We're in a trade war. Nothing has been achieved in trade. NAFTA 1.1 is an insignificant change to NAFTA, which still has to pass Congress. We'll see if that happens. But it doesn't do anything. NAFTA was pretty good to begin with. Now it's marginally about the same. So what has he done exactly on trade so far? Stand up for the globalist. Notice that he says globalist about 25 times during this 2.5-minute video. Globalist. What does he mean by globalist? Now, globalist is this massive package deal of one world government lefties who don't want the U.S. government, who hate the U.S. government, who want, you know, who don't believe in borders, don't believe in sovereignty, complete, you know, want one world government run by the United Nations, and free trade, free movement of capital, of goods and of labor, you know, which is globalization. One good thing, free trade, free movement of capital, free movement of labor, notice, not open borders, labor. And on the other hand, one world government. Put those all together and call it globalists. Oh, those evil globalists. They want to take away American sovereignty. They want to let the Chinese rule the world. Oh my God, beware. Scary, scary, scary stuff. Globalists and Wall Street and hedge fund guys. Ooh, I mean, can you imagine a more scary combination of one world government and bankers? Ooh, he's tapping into every little, you know, every one of the stereotypes, every single one of them. This is the method of appeal to emotion. I've been talking about this for months, for a year. Appeal to emotion, trying to scare the bejesus out of us, distort the reality. And again, this package deal is when you put into a concept two things that don't belong together. I am for globalization. I am for free movement of goods, capital, and labor. I think the last 50 years of globalization have been amazingly good for the United States of America, amazingly good for the world. But for the United States of America, first and foremost. But I'm not a one world government guy. Hate one world government. I believe in sovereignty. I believe in the United States protecting itself. I believe in a true, true, true America first foreign policy, not this pathetic attempt at the American first foreign policy that we're seeing this administration engage in. Oh, yeah. More Peter Navarro.
Stand up to the countries of the world that are engaging in unfair trade practices, non-reciprocal trade, high tech.
How do you do non-reciprocal trade? You know, this is a head scratcher. Non-reciprocal trade. I sell you something, I get cash. Is that a reciprocal trade or is that a non-reciprocal trade? Non-reciprocal trade or non-reciprocal trade? Seth, who's mentioning IP theft, I'm going to get to IP theft. I don't think Donald Trump cares one iota about IP theft. And of course, Peter Navarro will not mention it, but I will talk about IP theft. I've talked about IP theft every time I've talked about trade. I'll talk about it again because there's always new listeners. But how can you have non-reciprocal trade? I've said from the day Donald Trump appointed Peter Navarro that he is an absolute unmitigated idiot. He knows no economics. Now, he might not be an idiot. He might just be somebody who figured out that a certain pitch gets you power, gets you an appointment to the White House, gets you lots of television appearances, and he pursues that. But if he really believes what he says, he is an unmitigated idiot who knows no economics. He's got a PhD in economics, but knows no economics. How can you have unreciprocal trade? I repeat that. How do you do that? I give you something and you pay me money. I buy an iPhone. And is that unreciprocal trade? Did Apple not get anything for it? They got dollars. And I got an iPhone. When I buy something from China, what do I not get? What do I not get? Put aside Donald Trump's strategies, 3D chess. Put aside. I'm just analyzing what Pina Navarro, Donald Trump's U.S. National Trade Council director, the top guy on trade for the Trump administration, is saying. So we're just analyzing what he's saying. Forget about the 3D chess. How can unreciprocal trade even exist? Isn't it true that when we buy something with China, they get dollars and we get stuff? Isn't that reciprocal? Just as reciprocal as you buying something from Apple or you buying something from the grocery store. Unreciprocal trade does not exist. There is no such thing. Trade by definition. By definition is reciprocal. All I'm doing is pointing out that the chief advisor to Donald Trump on trade is an ignorant idiot. That's all. You guys then decide what you think about Trump. I'm just going to go back a little bit so you can hear that one again.
Reciprocal trade, high tariffs, high non-tariff barriers, using the world, using the United States as the piggy bank of the world.
How do you use the United States as a piggy bank of the world when we get stuff for every dollar we send overseas? For every dollar we trade, we get stuff. We get computers, we get iPhones, we get T-shirts, we get stuff. They get pieces of paper called dollars. Pieces of paper that do what? What do they do with those dollars? We've talked about this many times. They buy U.S. assets with them. They buy U.S. debt. We benefit twice. They buy our debt and we get their stuff. How do we lose from this? But he presented as if it's a loss. They've been using us as a piggy bank. Piggy bank. If anything, we've been using the Chinese as a piggy bank. We keep issuing debt and they don't buy our stuff. Again, listen to what Pina Navarro is saying. Forget about the big picture. Forget about the 3D chess. Listen to what he's saying. So what you're saying is it's okay to lie in order to achieve a big picture? Bullshit. Now we're going to get to IP theft, I promise. And to national security, whatever the hell this administration thinks that is. It has no clue what that is. All right, here we go.
Using the United States as the piggy bank of the world.
Piggy bank.
And running up a trade deficit every year because they do that of over $500 billion, which is a pure transfer of wealth abroad.
Oh, my God. A pure transfer of wealth abroad. Now, notice he didn't mention the Chinese here. So this is not just about China. So it can't be IP theft and it can't be national security. This is just trade. This is just a trade deficit being a net transfer of wealth. A net transfer of wealth abroad. I mean, I'm speechless. No, I'm not really. You sell somebody stuff. When I buy something at the grocery store, is that a net transfer of wealth? Who's losing? Who's losing wealth? Who is transferring wealth to whom? I give them money. I get stuff from the grocery store. When I buy stuff from China, they get money. What do I get back? I get back their goods. Again, think, forget passion, you know, emotion. Think. Where is the net transfer of wealth? I mean, I know you guys don't actually listen to the words. You don't want to because they don't make any sense. And you don't, you're so fixated by many of you. Sorry, not all of you. Many of you are so fixated by Donald Trump has to be right, that you don't actually listen to what's being said. But I'm giving you facts. I'm giving you his chief guy on trade, talking about trade, saying that trade, if there's a trade deficit, is a net transfer of wealth. How does that work mathematically? How does that work just based on, just do a balance sheet thing or an accounting transaction? How does it work with you in the grocery store? How does it work with China or with Germany? We have a net trade deficit with Germany, big trade deficit with Germany, and with Japan, with South Korea, with Mexico. How does it work with them? Are we transferring wealth to the South Koreans? Are we transferring wealth to the Germans when we buy stuff from them and they don't buy stuff from us? Is that a net transfer of wealth? That's confusing wealth with dollars. But wealth is more than dollars. Do the Germans steal our IP? Is Germany a national security threat to us? Is South Korea? Is Japan? And yet, this was not just about China. This is about trade. Trade deficits are net transfers of wealth.
Tariff barriers. Using the world, using the United States as the piggy bank of the world. And running up a trade deficit every year because they do that of over $500 billion, which is a pure transfer of wealth abroad. Jobs, factories, money. That's all.
Jobs, factories, money? What are we talking about again? Most of the jobs and manufacturers that have been lost, over 80% of them, have been lost in the United States because of transfer to technology, because of robots, because of computers. And we produce, in terms of actual manufacturing goods, double what we produced 30 years ago. We produce more stuff today than ever before. We transfer money to China, but what happens to that money? I said this again. That money comes back because they buy our bonds. So there's no transfer of money. Factories? What are we? There are more factories. They're just now run by computers instead of by people in the United States than ever before. And how does any of this deal with IP theft? None of it does. How did renegotiating NAFTA deal with IP theft? It didn't. How did tariffs on steel on Canada deal with IP theft? It didn't. How did tariffs on the European Union deal with IP theft? It didn't. It's stunning to me how blind people, how unthinking people are when it comes to a simple issue of trade and how much they're willing to buy this demagogy from somebody like Peter Navarro, who sounds like Elizabeth Warren. This sounds like any Marxist or any leftist who is a materialist. It sounds like Elizabeth Warren. This could be an Elizabeth Warren speech easily. Easily. There's no difference on trade, on these kind of issues in economics from Elizabeth Warren and Peter Navarro.
$1 trillion, which is a pure transfer of wealth abroad. Jobs, factories, money. That's like a reverse mortgage on this country. Donald J. Trump has done an amazing job of addressing that issue, and he didn't need the help.
I just say trade deficit is bigger today than it's ever been. It's the biggest we've ever seen. Now we'll see. Everybody says, well, the tariffs haven't completely kicked in. We'll see next year. But my prediction is next year it'll just be as big as it is this year. The tariffs don't by themselves reduce the trade deficit. Well, actually, we'll reduce the trade deficit is when the U.S. goes into recession. When recessions happen, trade deficit goes down because Americans stop buying stuff. And therefore, they buy fewer things from China. If you think that's a good thing, then let's have a recession.
Done an amazing job of addressing that issue, and he didn't need the help of Wall Street. He didn't need the help of Goldman Sachs, and he doesn't need it now. And here's the most important point. When these unpaid foreign agents engage in this kind of diplomacy.
This is American bankers, American hedge fund guys, lobbying for American interests. He's going to say foreign agents, I don't know how many times, just again, to create that false view in your mind and to trigger the anti-Wall Street, anti-banking, anti-bankers mentality of so many in this country, which is so sad. I've written a whole book on just that topic, The Moral Case for Finance. You can find it on Amazon.
All they do is weaken this president and his negotiating position. No good can come of this. If there is a deal, if and when there is a deal, it will be on President Donald J. Trump's terms, not Wall Street terms. But if Wall Street is involved and continues.
I'll just say that's scary because Donald J. Trump's terms, I think, are scary for America. They're not good for America. If Peter Navarro represents Trump in trade, these are not going to be good terms for America.
insinuate itself into these negotiations, there will be a stench around any deal that's consummated, because it will have the imprimatur of Goldman Sachs and Wall Street.
So anything with the imprimatur of Goldman Sachs and Wall Street, notice, being Goldman Sachs, the villains, those good Jewish names we can use now, to really portray those financiers in concrete terms and highlight them, right? But the hatred of Wall Street, the stench of Wall Street and Goldman Sachs. Wow.
I would urge these unpaid foreign agents to stand
there
down on this issue. No good can come of it. If they want to do good, then spend their billions in Dayton, Ohio, in the factory towns of America, where we need a rebirth of our manufacturing base and an end to the opioid crisis, which they helped create by offshoring our production.
All right. So now Wall Street, let me get rid of that. Now Wall Street is guilty of opioid crisis. It's Wall Street's fault. Wow. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. You cannot make this stuff up. And the ignorance and the playing on stereotypes and the playing on the evil of Wall Street is so disgusting. It's so disgusting. Read my book on the Mall Case for Finance, where I discuss the history of exactly this, of this kind of approach to finance and what it usually represents. It is truly atrocious that anybody in government will be talking like this. A third-rate economist who's now being given a position of power and who now wields this power over this country, and it has the potential to destroy us. Now, he sounds like a socialist. He sounds like Elizabeth Warren. That's what he sounds like. Now, let me address the IP issue, since it was brought up on YouTube, although it wasn't a super chat. You can ask me questions on super chat. There were a couple. Let's see if I can still get back to them. Yeah, I'll get to them in a second. I just want to deal with IP, and then I'll do these two questions. IP, I've said this 1,000 times. It should be illegal, and is illegal, there are laws on the books, to trade in stolen goods. If you can show the particular product made in China or made in Bangladesh or made in Germany, I don't care, anywhere in the world, involves stolen IP, if you can show that in court, then that product should be banned from the United States, no matter what it is. It should be banned. Not tariffs. Not place a tax on American citizens for buying it. It should be banned. If you believe that the Chinese are stealing U.S. technology, then deal with it as a national security threat. Ban those products, ban those companies, do what you're doing with Russia, go after specific individuals or specific companies that are responsible for presenting a national security threat to the United States, if it's national security. But if it's IP, even if it's just IP, it's not a national security threat, just theft. Ban all products that have been shown to be based on theft. We don't allow Gucci bags into the U.S. that are fake because of the intellectual property theft. We shouldn't allow chips, not the ones you eat, the ones in computers, that are based on intellectual property theft. There's no difference between that and a Gucci bag. Just don't allow it in the U.S. Ban it. But of course, nobody wants to talk about that, because all of the people supporting Trump's trade policy don't really care about IP. They don't care one iota about IP. Donald Trump doesn't, Peter Navarro doesn't, and I suspect the people on YouTube defending them don't, because that's the solution to the IP issue. That's always been the solution to the IP issue. Tariffs are not a solution and won't be a solution. And they're not going to get a solution through tariffs for that. So you don't tax your own people in order to reduce theft by somebody else. To reduce theft, you ban those products, or you encourage your allies to ban those products, and you embargo them, and you penalize them, and you take them to court, and you freeze their assets. You treat them like criminals, We have a system in place to treat criminals as criminals. You don't have to invent the wheel here. So to the extent that there's intellectual property theft, and there is intellectual property theft, then and Donald Trump has not brought it up. He only brought it up after the fact, after his ridiculous America First trade policy was revealed to be ridiculous as it was. He brought this up as an excuse for what he was doing. But he doesn't care, and I'll say this one more time, one iota about intellectual property theft. And he doesn't understand the issue. And you will see that the policy puts in place will do nothing to there's nothing broken about trade other than this intellectual property theft that has to be addressed that past administrations have not addressed because nobody has the balls to do it. And Donald Trump certainly has no balls to do it. He is much more engaged in what his old advisor, the guy who ran his campaign, who used to be at Breitbart, God, somebody help me out with a name. He is much more engaged in what they've called many times economic nationalism. He's much more engaged Stephen Bannon. He's much more engaged in what Steve Bannon called economic nationalism. He is much more engaged in the idea of that Peter Navarro just reflected and that Donald Trump has tweeted over and over again, this idea of zero-sum economics, this idea that when you buy stuff from a manufacturer in another country, you're doing a wealth transfer to that country. So he's been influenced by what I call stupid economics. It's not even bad economics. It's stupid economics. No actual economist believes it. There's no economist, even on the left, who actually thinks this is true. Not on the left or on the right. There's no economist who thinks trade deficits are a problem, except Navarro. And there's just no economist who thinks this. Now, that's an appeal to authority. But I've already shown just from the simple mathematics and the simple economics of it that it doesn't make any sense. And this relates, this tribalism or collectivism in economics, which Trump is guilty of and Bannon is really guilty of. Okay. I've got two Super Chat questions. Let me take them quickly. Explain to my two-year-old the main types of trade, stocks versus bonds, long versus short. How do I explain what a hedge fund manager does? Your two-year-old can't understand what it shouldn't understand. You should never try to explain these kind of context to a two-year-old. A two-year-old has no context with which to understand any of this. You have to be probably in your early teens before you can understand any of it. So start with that. Don't let's not pretend that two-year-olds can understand abstract concepts because they can't. Stocks are an ownership claim. They're a residual claim. They're an ownership claim on an asset. You own this asset. You get to direct the use of this asset. When you buy a stock in a company, you're an owner. And through the board of directors, through voting on the board of directors, through voting on amendments to the charter of the business, you get to control that business. The board of directors represents you in chartering the course of the business and how those assets are allocated. Bonds are borrowing, the IOUs, I owe you money. When you issue a bond, you're basically borrowing money from people. Bond is an IOU, it's a piece of paper, that's all it is. Going long is buying a stock. Going short is borrowing the stock from somebody else and then selling it, believing that it will go down in price and you'll buy it again and return the stock that you borrowed from whoever you borrowed. That's the simplest explanation of those concepts. What does a hedge fund manager do? He trades stocks. He buys, he buys and sells. He goes long and short based on his evaluation of the value of the stocks. And every hedge fund does this differently. But basically, they buy and sell stocks. They also do. They might buy and sell currencies. They might buy and sell bonds. But they are traders. They trade in securities based on their best judgment of the value of those securities. They try to buy. They try to buy low and sell high. You know, in short high and buy long, buy low. So, and hedge funds legally are structured differently than mutual funds, but they basically do the same thing. The one thing that hedge funds are allowed to do that mutual funds for the most part are not, is short stocks, is short financial assets, any kind of financial asset, not just a stock. And also they can trade in options, which most mutual funds I think cannot. So there are legal differences. I think that answered that question. What if one world government were based on individualism, libertarian principles? I'd still be against it. For the primary reason is one world government doesn't give you any options, right? This is one of the reasons I want, particularly in a 100% free world, I would like to see open borders, the ability to move from one country to another. What happens if it starts out like that, but then goes rotten? What happens if it starts by, by being pro individual rights, like America did for the most part, and then goes south? You can't leave. It's the only place there is. So there's a value to having some competition. It's also true that governing is not easy. And even if you have 20 rights-respecting governments, they are probably not going to do, a great job. No, that's not my point. If you have 20, right? I misspoke there, sorry. If you have rights-respecting governments, then it's probably the case that they will have on certain issues different laws. And it's not always clear. It's not obvious how you define in particular terms property rights or what is the best punishment for particular crimes. It's why we have federalism in America. There is a value in having some diversity between states in certain types of law, as long as they're not violating individual rights like slavery was, or like I think abortion would be. Let's say every state have a different abortion law and some would ban it. That would be a violation of individual rights. As long as they're not banning, as long as they're not doing something that clearly violates individual rights, every state has some flexibility in terms of how it structures its laws. And I think that is a good thing. So having that competition to innovate and to try out different things and to see what works and what doesn't is a good thing, because it's hard always just philosophically to figure out in the law what is right and what is wrong. So I would suggest that in the world there would be something between 20 to 50 different states. I think it's ridiculous that we have 200 states. I think they're way too many. I would like to see something like 20 to 50. I think bigger units are better, but I don't think one unit is ideal. I think you have to have enough units to have competition, but also not to have balkanization, to have this ethnocentric, barbaric, primitive, form of ethno-state, which is what we have in Europe. I think the failure of Europe over the last 300 years, or over the last 200 years, and one of the reasons we have had two world wars that have led to millions of people dying, and even between after the World War, when the wall came down, you still had wars in places like Yugoslavia, is the emphasis in Europe on ethnicity, the emphasis in Europe on the ethno-state, and the balkanization of Europe. And if you want to know what Ayn Rand thought about that, then she has a fantastic essay on called Global Balkanization, which describes exactly this issue. And Ayn Rand actually discusses world government and this issue in a new textbook of Americanism, which Jonathan Honing has just published, and which I recommend to everybody. I mean, you'll get a really clear view of an expanded view of Ayn Rand's thinking about politics. There's a fantastic supplement to New Textbook on Americanism, never published before, Ayn Rand, where she was doing seminars on political thought that has been taken from the Ayn Rand archives and published in the New Textbook of Americanism as part of the book, in addition to her essay that she wrote in the 1940s on Americanism, plus multiple essays by a lot of objectivist intellectuals on different application of Americanism or the ideas she brings up in her essay to the world in which we live in today. I have an essay that covers a bunch of issues that I think she would have addressed, or questions she didn't ask. For example, nationalism, immigration, that she didn't cover, that I think if she was writing it today, she would cover. So excellent, excellent book. Anybody interested in Ayn Rand's politics should buy it. Anybody interested in objectivism, but anybody interested in politics in general, interested in in the world of politics, one of the best books in the world on this. So Jonathan Honing gets a lot of kudos for publishing it and marketing it, and the Ayn Rand Institute is going to be helping market the book. And I'm looking forward to doing some events with Jonathan, promoting the book. Jonathan's going to be on the show here. We're going to talk about the book. And I'm very, very excited to be part of the project. You guys should be too. Anyway, that's my thoughts about one world government. It's just not a good idea. It's not a good idea. And but, you know, I do believe strongly that in a free world, you should have a free movement of goods, capital, and labor. And I think that aspect of the European Union, the aspect of free movement of capital within the countries within the European Union, of free movement of capital, goods, and labor is fantastic. And one of the reasons Europe, in spite of some of its socialist policies, has done relatively well in the last 30 years. And, you know, free trade is massive. The benefits of trade are massive. The amount that we have benefited from trade from China is, we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars of wealth. We're talking about a significant increase in the standard of living of Americans, particularly lower income and middle income Americans have benefited unbelievably from trade, from the existence of cheap goods that they can afford that raise their own standard of living. All right, again, I'm running out of time to talk about tribalism and economics, but so let me just talk about it a little bit here, and then I'm sure we'll come back to the topic later on. As you saw with Peter Navarro, as you see with the Trump administration, as you see with Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, left, right, center, doesn't really matter. It's all dominated by what I would call a tribalistic, collectivistic approach to economics. They all talk about American jobs as if America employs people. They all talk about American trade as if Americans, as a group, trade with anybody. They all talk even about GDP, which is a gross national product, which is a very flawed measure of what? Of the growth of the economy. But what does that mean? What does that mean to me? What does that mean to you? What do policies that grow GDP mean necessarily to me and you? They talk about wages being stagnant. Well, are my wages stagnant? Are your wages stagnant? Whose wages are stagnant? Some people's wages might be stagnant. Other people's wages might be great. What does the average mean? Why should we care about the average? They talk about zero-sum economics in terms of China, in terms of Germany, in terms of trade. It's zero sum. The U.S. China's economy is growing faster than the U.S. economy. It's becoming bigger faster than the U.S. economy is becoming bigger. As if that's a threat. Inequality. It's the same kind of threat. They talk about some people getting richer faster than I'm getting richer. As if that's a threat to me. Immigrants. Low wages of U.S. employees, we are told. High-end immigrants as well as low-end immigrants. We should ban immigration. Even people who work for a living. Because they hurt wages. Whose wages? Who benefit? Who loses? Whose decision is it? All of these ideas are collectivistic ways of thinking about the world. Government should have no policy with regard to trade. Let me say this again. Government should have no policy with regard to trade. Now, as I said before, if somebody's stealing stuff, that's when the government should get involved. So if some company in China steals American IP, then take that company to court, ban its products, try to freeze its assets, penalize it. If the Chinese government is stealing American IP, then that's a foreign policy issue. But trade, government has no business in trade if what we care about is the individual. Because how does one approach trade from an individualistic perspective versus a collectivistic perspective? Well, I want to buy something. that happens to be made in China. You want to buy something that happens to be made in South Korea. Joe wants to buy something that happens to be made in Germany. An individualistic approach to trade, an individualistic approach to economics, individualistic approach to economic policy says, go do it. If you can afford to buy it from China, if you believe based on your rational mind that the good from China is the best for you, none of my business. Same if you believe the best good for you is from Germany or from, as long as the country you're training with is not an enemy, an imminent threat to the United States, like maybe North Korea and Iran are today, then it's none of the government's business and none of economists' business who I trade with. Yeah, economists can keep track mathematically of who's trading with who and aggregate these numbers because that's what economists do. They like to aggregate numbers. But it has no meaning. I, as an individual, have chosen to trade with an individual in China. None of anybody's business. Doesn't hurt my neighbor. If my neighbor loses his job, my neighbor loses his job. But my neighbor might have lost his job because I choose to trade with somebody in Arkansas instead of my neighbor. It's none of the business of anybody whose job are lost or whose jobs are gained and where they're gained and where they're lost and what the reasons are. Or if the reasons are for my choice of trade, your product might be obsolete now. So you lose your job. Go find another one. So government has no business interfering and intervening in my choices, in what I choose to do in life. Now, the left understands this when it comes to sex, when it comes to who I have sex with, what gender they happen to be. Then the left says, oh, individuals should be able to choose that for themselves. And they're right. But somehow the left and the right has a problem if I choose to buy my stuff from Japan and not from my neighbor, from Mexico and not from my neighbor. It's none of their business. It's my choice. And all trade is you and me buying stuff. We go to Walmart or we go to Nordstrom or we go to Saks Fifth Avenue and we look at the label and it says made in whatever. And we can make a choice. If we don't want to trade with somebody in China for whatever reason, we can choose not to. If we only want to buy French clothes, then we can buy only French clothes. But it's your rational choice as an individual. It's the same choice that I believe we should have about what we should ingest in terms of food, what we should ingest in terms of drugs, what we should, who we should sleep with, where we should live, who we should marry, what we buy. The government now wants to tell us what we should buy and what we shouldn't buy. Oh, no, you shouldn't buy stuff from China. Now, you guys can recommend to me not to buy stuff from China, but it's none of your business. In the end of the day, it's for me to decide. And the same is true. The same is true. If you're an individualist, if you think of these issues as an individualist, on who you employ. As long as you're not employing a criminal, as long as you're not employing a terrorist, then it's none of anybody's business who I employ. I might employ somebody, a woman. I might want to employ a man. I might want to employ somebody who's gay. I might want to employ somebody who was born in Mexico. I might want to employ somebody who was born in China. Why is it your business? Why is it anybody's business? It's my life, my choices. The person I bring from China to work in my factory, or the person I bring from Mexico to work in my factory, or the program I bring from Scandinavia to work in my software company, in my startup, then why is it your business? Why should you care? Particularly, let's assume now there's no welfare, all schools are private, so let's take the welfare side out of it. Because somebody said, even in a free world, no open immigration. But why is that your business? Why is it your business? So Somebody's asking about guns. I'll just answer this quickly. Guns are a special case, and let's talk about guns another time. I don't think selling and trading with guns should be treated as selling and trading with everything else. Guns are an instrument of violence, the primary instrument of violence, and the government has a role in regulating it. It's one of the only goods that government should be regulating. But that gets me all kinds of trouble with you guys, so I'm not gonna go there too much, right? So if I want to drive my truck down to – not drive my truck down. If I want to hand out a bunch of airplane tickets to a bunch of programmers in Sweden to come and work for my startup in Silicon Valley, how is that any of anybody's business? Why can my neighbor now choose to intervene in my affairs and tell me who I can marry and who I can't? Which is the equivalent of I'm bringing them over to work for me. Why is that your business? So an individualist perspective on the world doesn't look at how many jobs Americans have. Doesn't look at immigration. Doesn't look at trade from a national perspective. The only concern economic policy has in an individualist world, the only concern economic policy has in an individualist world is the securing of freedom. The freedom to trade with anybody I want to. The freedom to engage in an employment contract with anybody I want to. The freedom to move around, to come in and out of the country without being harassed. It's freedom that economic policy should be concerned with from an individualist perspective, not aggregate numbers. Government would not keep track of GDP. Government would not keep track of employment. Because in a free world, there are plenty of jobs. Plenty of jobs. And if you don't build infrastructure in a free world, then you will struggle. But we know people are rational. People are self-interested. And they will build infrastructure because it is in their self-interest. And history is full of examples of this. From the first canals that were built by private enterprise. The first roads that were built by private enterprise. The first ports that were built. In America, at least. I'm talking about America. And then the government takes them over. And then the government monopolizes the sector. Railroads that were successful were built by private enterprise. Railroads that were failures were subsidized by government. Why is a railroad any different than a road? So, no, government doesn't have to do any of that. Government has no involvement in the economy. And government doesn't get itself, and we should not be thinking about, why do I care about American jobs? I should care about, am I creating wealth? And are there opportunities for me to trade? And is my quality of my life increasing? And yeah, I might care about my neighbor having a job, but my neighbor's job is not dependent. It's dependent on my neighbor and dependent on entrepreneurial activity. And under freedom, there's never any problem with entrepreneurial activity. There's never any problem of job creation under freedom. All the government's responsibility is to maintain the freedom, to secure it, to pass laws that help secure it, laws that define property rights in new circumstances, but otherwise leave us alone. But the whole way in which we approach economics today, the modeling we do, the differential equations that are done, the Federal Reserve trying to tell us what the right interest rates is, what's it any of their business? I'll go into a bank and negotiate with my bank the appropriate interest rate. And if I can't find a loan at the interest rates I want, I won't take a loan. Supply and demand. The marketplace, free choices of individuals transacting voluntarily should be the only standard in economics. And if it's not voluntary, is the only place in which government should intervene. If I'm being forced to do something, then the government should intervene. So the whole way in which we approach economics today, buy American. Shouldn't I buy what maximizes my well-being? Shouldn't I buy what is best for my life? If you think that involves a particular country, then do it. But it's none of the government's business to impose that on me. It's my responsibility. And if buy American, why not buy local? That's a big thing now. Buy local. Really? Maybe the best thing is just for me to try to produce everything. Now, there's a drop in the standard of living, if ever you've seen one, when we all go back to subsistence farming and try to produce everything we consume. Maybe that's the ideal. No, trade is the ideal. And the more distant the trade, I'd say the better the economy is. The fact that we run a trade deficit is a good thing, not a bad thing. It means we're producing a lot of wealth and we can afford to buy the products, the best products all over the world. We have the money and they're willing to take our money because we're doing something good. A trade deficit is a sign of virtue, not of vice. We're creating something. We're creating wealth. And we're using that wealth to buy stuff from people who are better at producing it than we are. Isn't that wonderful? It is from an individualist perspective because it enhances our lives as individuals. That freedom enhances our lives. Now, what a mixed economy does, and I know there's a super chat question out there, and I'll get to it. What a mixed economy does, where the government intervenes, where the government tells us what we can and cannot buy, and taxes us and taxes this behavior, but doesn't tax that behavior. I mean, even taxes, people say to me, oh, we lowered taxes. Did we? Well, we didn't lower taxes on everybody. Corporations got lower taxes. That's good. I'm all for that. But if you live in California, you live in New York, your individual taxes went up quite a bit under Donald Trump. So we didn't all get a tax cut. I'd like to see all of us, at least all of us who pay taxes, get a tax cut. And I'm not sure that is even the right approach in the interim of going towards zero taxes. What about the fact that I would like to see everybody paying taxes? Rich and poor. Fact is, there are quite a few Americans who don't pay taxes today. They should pay something. How about we all pay the same, like 10%? That's a more individualistic approach than saying, you guys, this group should pay X, this group should pay Y, this group gets a deduction, that group doesn't get a deduction. These things it's worthy of deduction, charity, for example. These things are not worthy of deduction, state taxes now. Why? By what standard? Because this group lobbied harder than that group. Realtors, real estate people lobbied hard not to take away the mortgage deduction, but states that have high tax rate happen to be blue states, so we'll screw them. That's not an individualistic approach to lowering taxes. An individualist approach to lowering taxes is increasing freedom. That is increasing choices, which means no exclusions, no deductions. No attempt of the tax code to manipulate your behavior. No attempt of the tax code to tell you what's good or what's bad. That's true of corporate taxes. It's still true, for example, that if you're in real estate, there are all kinds of ways you can avoid paying taxes. It's pretty cool. Or defer taxes basically forever. It's why, I won't say it's relatively easy, sounds wrong, but building wealth in real estate is easier. It's still really, really hard and takes incredible talent. And very few people are good at it. But it's relatively easier because it's easier not to pay taxes. And if you don't pay taxes, you can accumulate wealth much faster than if you do pay taxes. Why? Why are some things deductible for corporations and other things not deductible for corporations? Why is the government interfering in any of this? That's not, again, an individualistic approach to taxes. An individualistic approach to taxes is everybody pays exactly the same. And or a consumption tax or something where everybody is guided by a single standard and where we're not differentiating and not preferring some people over others. I'm not complaining about a lower corporate tax rate. I think a lower corporate tax rate is great. Probably the best, single best thing this Republican Congress and this president have done. But it's not enough. And it's still, the whole approach to it was collectivist. And it's still true that there are plenty of corporations who get breaks from taxes. There are plenty of corporations who get subsidies, explicit subsidies where they get cash. I think that's all wrong. I think that's all wrong. I think taxes should be low, simple, no exclusions, no deductions, not at a corporate level, not an individual level, for anything. I don't want the government telling me what is preferred and what is not, what is right and what is not, what I should consume and what I shouldn't, what I should invest in and what I shouldn't. Short-term and long-term capital gains are taxed differently. Why? Who? Where does that come from? That's pure collectivism in economics. So we need to stop thinking in these aggregate terms, in these macro perspectives, macroeconomics. Who cares? What matters is microeconomics. What matters is what we do as independent agents. And if you ask the question, what is the best thing in microeconomics? It's freedom. It's leave people alone. Let them make choices. And as an economist, we might try to explain that, might try to show how it works, but we'd never argue to manipulate it because that would go against the principle of freedom. So the only economic policy, the only economic principle from a policy perspective is proper definition of property rights, the protection of property rights, which gets into the IP question from before, and freedom. Leave people alone. That's it. So all this trade deficit discussion, jobs discussion, wages discussion is irrelevant. Some people's wages go down in a free market. Some people's wages go up. Some people lose jobs. Some people gain jobs. Who are we going to benefit? Which group is more important? How do we weight them? The greatest suffering, that's more important. Some people sell stuff. Some people buy stuff. Who said one's better than the other? But a collectivist approach tries to take all these groups and tries to rank them. It's like intersectionality in economics. Who is suffering the most? Oh, it's steelworkers. You know, Navarro said that in the clip I showed you. Steelworkers. Wall Street should be investing in them because they're suffering the most. That's like the transgender minority. They're the most oppressed. So we should invest the most in them. No, 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 no. That's not the standard for anything. Need, suffering, oppression is not the standard for anything. But that's what a collectivistic approach is. And there's always going to be pressure groups. Should I have tariffs on steel? That'll be good for the steel industry. But it'd be bad for the people who use steel because their prices will go up. So do I care more about the employees of the steel industry or more about the employees of those people who use steel? How do I decide? I don't know. That's collectivist economics. Free market economics is let's supply and demand. Work it out. Whatever the market determines, that's what will happen. And if people have to shift jobs, if steel manufacturing has to shut down, so be it. So be it. Get out of the way. And there's nobody left or right arguing for that on the political scene today. I mean, maybe one or two congressmen or senators, but almost nobody. Okay, I've got another question on this IP stuff. Can businesses in China use US IP and products domestically but not sell them in the US? Is that okay, or does the U.S. protect products in foreign countries? It absolutely protects products in foreign countries. This is what U.S. foreign policy should be about. This is what you should have a State Department. The only reason you should have a State Department, almost, is to protect the lives and property of Americans. So if you're in China and you get into trouble, the State Department should help you. If China steals your IP, the State Department should help you. So to the extent the diplomacy matters, to the extent that the U.S. government has any leverage on China, on the Chinese government, to the extent that we can freeze assets of companies in the U.S. or freeze the Chinese government's assets in the U.S., and the Chinese government has a lot of assets in the U.S., then we should apply whatever pressure is necessary to make Chinese companies or Indian companies or African companies, because IP is being stolen everywhere in the world, stop the theft of IP. It's stealing. And we should do that all over the world. And if you took all the diplomatic muscle that the United States has and applied it just to the protecting of the lives and property of Americans, then wow, then you'd have a lot of muscle. Apply to one thing instead of the million other things, bringing peace to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for example. Instead of spending all your time doing that, spend the time pounding these countries into submission on the issue of IP. And there are all kinds of leverage you can use as the United States of America. Right? So, it would not be hard, in my view, to put that kind of pressure on the Chinese to stop it. And you do what you can, but you don't do it by raising taxes on your own citizens. That cannot be a means to an end. Any end. Never mind this end. All right. Hopefully you enjoyed that. That's some of my thoughts on kind of tribalism and economics. There's a lot more to say about it, and how it impacts. I mean, think about this point, that the wealth you produce it, you did build that. And that's part of why taxes are so evil, because they take your stuff. Whereas a collectivist view, an Obama view, is you didn't build that. So whatever wealth seemingly you created is collectively owned. And then taxes are just redistributing the wealth that we all own anyway to the people who deserve it. Think about the pie analogy. I talked a lot about that in my inequality talks. The pie analogy, if we think about wealth from a collectivistic perspective as a pie, then we want to redistribute the pie. We want to make sure that everybody gets the appropriate piece of pie. But if we think about wealth as an individual pie, then don't touch my pie. It's my pie. It's none of your pie. Leave my pie alone. So the whole perspective on economics, on taxes, changes based on the question of who built it, whether you have an individualistic answer to who built it or collectivistic answer to who built it. And again, I think both parties in power today are collectivists. All mixed economy advocates are collectivists. Almost all economists today are collectivists, because this is exactly how they think. They think in terms of a pie. They think in terms of trade deficits. They think in terms of, wages, the impact immigrants have on wages, somebody's wages. All of that is a wrong way of thinking about the world from a policy perspective, from a political perspective. All right. Thank you, everybody. And I will see you, I don't know when. I hope you watch the live stream tomorrow when I'm in London. I'm having a conversation with Brandon O'Neill, which I'm looking forward to. He's a really interesting guy and smart, and he's got that British accent, which makes him even sound even smarter. And it's going to be a good discussion. It's going to be about free speech, but primarily specifically about whether Facebook and Twitter and YouTube should be broken up on free speech grounds. Just bizarre. But I'm sure we'll talk about a lot of other things. And so watch that. That'll be on the Ayn Rand Institute live stream, but it'll also be on my channel. I will put it up on my channel after the fact. I will then be giving a high school talk and a university talk in England. I'll also be attending the Ayn Rand lecture. Please come. Bring your friends if you live in England. Bring your friends. It should be terrific. Michael. Anyway, his name just slipped my mind, but that's okay. That's what happens to me. Is going to be talking about biotech, freedom, Ayn Rand, reason. It's going to be a fascinating lecture. Then I'm going to go to Slovakia, not Slovenia, Slovakia. Those little ethno states. I'm going to go to the ethno state of Slovakia, who did not want to be with the Czech people. They wanted to be with only with the Slav people. Slovakia to talk about freedom, free markets, morality of freedom, morality of capitalism. Then I go to Poland. I'll be talking outside of Warsaw somewhere, 3-hour drive from Warsaw, I hear. Then I'm going to go to Prague, and I'm going to be talking in Prague. Then I'm going to go to Copenhagen. I'm going to be doing a real interesting discussion. There's a big issue in Copenhagen right now in Denmark about Ayn Rand's influence. And it's in all the newspapers, the top TV shows. They're all talking about Ayn Rand's influence. So I'm going to be on a panel about why is Ayn Rand still a thing with Lars Christensen, who's on the board of the Ayn Rand Institute, and somebody who is a philosopher who's kind of mixed on Ayn Rand. Of course, his name is Michael Kaufman. I apologize. Michael Kaufman, who's giving the Ayn Rand talk. Then I go to Tbilisi in Georgia, one of my favorite places, where I'm going to give three talks. I'm going to give a talk at Free University. I'm going to give a talk for the John Galt School. Did you know there was a John Galt School in Europe, Eastern Europe, that is running seminars right now in Tbilisi? I'm going to be talking for them. And then I will give a talk at the Students for Liberty Regional Conference in Tbilisi for something like 600-700 people. Yes, it's in Turun, Poland, my talk in Poland, 3 hours from Warsaw. And then I go to Israel, and I'm going to be giving a talk in Israel, probably a debate. It's still not clear, but it'll be at Ben-Gurion University in Be'er Sheva, and it will be on, let me just check the calendar, this one, because I know there are a number of you Israelis listening in. It'll be on the 26th of November, the 26th of November in Be'er Sheva, in Ben-Gurion University in Be'er Sheva. So if you're in Israel, I hope you come. It'll be a debate. It'll be fun. There'll be a lot of, I think, a big audience. And so that'll be quite a bit. I think 7 countries, the UK, Slovakia, Poland, Czech Republic, Copenhagen, Denmark, Tbilisi, Georgia, and Be'er Sheva, Israel. And then I come home. All right. Thank you all. Thanks for listening to the show. Don't forget to share it. If you find value in these shows, please support the show. Express your value in a trade by sending a few dollars my way. You can do so on patreon.com/YaronBrook Show or on paypal.me/YaronBrook. And of course, subscribe to my YouTube channel. Go to Facebook and Twitter and everything else, but YouTube is the primary thing that I would appreciate your subscription on. All right. Thanks, everybody. Great to be talking to you. Thanks for the Super Chat members. And we'll talk from somewhere in Europe, probably from London, from my hotel room in London. But if not from there, maybe from Slovakia. That should be fun. Bye, everybody.